Jim, and welcome to Sartorik's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of January 2018. Join us this month as we talk with author Brad Schreiber about his book, Revolution's End, The Patty Hearst Kidnapping, Mind Control, and the Secret History of Donald DeFries and the SLA, and the upcoming Sartorik bus tour inspired by his research. We'll also visit with Linda Jensen and her son, Adam Wadlow, multi-year winners of an Arcadia Beautiful Holiday Decoration Award for their astonishing display of vintage illuminated blow mold plastic figures. So stay tuned.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood. Called Herman between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Bruce Here's Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of January 2018. This episode will have interviews with author Brad Schreiber. He'll be talking about his book, Revolution's End, The Patty Hearst Kidnapping, Mind Control, and the Secret History of Donald DeFries. He is giving a bus tour based on this book next month, so we'll talk all about that. We'll also be speaking with Linda Jensen and her son, Adam Wadlow. They are multi-year winners of an Arcadia Beautiful Holiday Decoration Award for their astonishing display of vintage illuminated blow mold plastic figures. So Kim, let's just jump into the deep end, episode number 124. You are the Pishka Maven. Take it away.
Well, I mean, Why shouldn't I shake the sack in front of you when I tell you we're doing an episode about mind control, the Sibionese Liberation Army, and vintage Christmas decorations in Arcadia? Only You Can't Eat the Sunshine would bring you such things, and, you know, you, our gentle listeners, are our supporters. We do not harangue you or barrage you with ads for ways to send emails to people or instant bedding that arrives that is all folded up and it goes puff and then you have it and it's big, as big as a real bed. We don't do any of that. We just say, hey, if you dig what we do and you'd like to make a contribution, we have a tip jar and we're always grateful for your contributions. It's never obligatory, always appreciated. And yes, we will blow it on gasoline and chili relleno burritos. You wouldn't have it any other way. Thanks for your support.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, so let's In the new year, we have a lot of closely watched trains. That's what we'll be doing right now, our closely watched train episode, before we segue to the interviews. So Kim, I'm gonna ask you to toot your own horn and tell us about your amazing annual historic preservation survey, which you just, the ink is still drawing on.
Virtually. You know, we've been doing this since 2012. Every year we look over the last year of newsletters and things that we've called out as important preservation wins and crises and losses. I tried at an earlier stage to keep this to 25 items spread between those three categories. This is no longer possible. This is actually a year where we hit 37, and the vast majority of items on that list, and you can see it at esoteric.com/2017preservation, the vast majority of items on the list are in this bittersweet category. Bittersweet being the category of things that haven't been saved, they haven't been lost, it's not too late, things are looking dire. It's all up to you, Angelinos, to get involved and help save these things. And every single item on the list is worth caring about. To be honest with you, Richard, it's kind of emotional to revisit 365 days of preservation problems in a single moment. But as I was working on it, you know, I usually try not to be contentious, especially on the internet. So many people are contentious on the internet. But in the last year, in addition to so many items on this bittersweet list, what I've noticed is that there's this kind of amateur, quote-unquote, street team of people who are just, they claim that they're urbanists, but what they are is boosters for demolition. And here's my message to you if you're listening to this podcast, if you hate listening to this podcast because you think we're idiots because we care about Los Angeles, our home, where we were born, where our parents were born, which is the most interesting place in the world. If you're from somewhere else and you've come to LA and you've drunk the Kool-Aid because you read an article in GQ which said you should buy an apartment downtown and you realize you got hustled and your response is to hang out in the comment section on local blogs and say, tear it all down. We need more new things built by people from out of town, which remind me of my hometown of Redlands. Just stop and go home. Because Angelenos actually give a shit about their community. And what you'll find if you visit my preservation list, which I compiled with Richard's aid, is calling out by name people who really care about the city. People who are not lobbyists. They're not getting invited to parties by politicians. They're not getting patted on the head by people who are developing vast swaths of clear-cutting. They just care. And they're doing the work, and they're saving things because it's the right thing to do. And people come to Los Angeles because this place is special, because of the people who've been here before, the work they've done, the things they've built. And we're not interested in the garbage that you want to replace it with, so please, go home. Go do some good work on urbanism in your incredibly interesting, in its own right, hometown. Because I'm not down on you because you're from Redlands. I just think you're doing really bad work in Los Angeles and you should go away. Thank you. With love. Happy New Year.
Wow, that was thank you, Kim.
From the heart, Richard.
Yeah. Okay. So moving forward, Kim, we're gonna I'm gonna toss in your lap another trigger issue, Pershing Square.
I love Pershing Square. It's great. Department of Rec and Parks is demolishing it, even though we have a architecturally distinguished plan there. It's kind of interesting because Jose Huizar, councilman for CD14, who managed to obtain this wonderful little finger of downtown as part of his district a few years back, he has so many ideas. They're not great. They're all really elaborate, and they all seem to touch stuff we care about. One of them is the notion of reviving Pershing Square, which is not a bad idea, if I may say so. We said it first. We were petitioning for the notion of restoring Pershing Square. Several thousand people signed a petition to the city and to Councilman Huizar, so he saw this, saying, hey, John Parkinson gave this amazing design for the park to the city in 1910. Let's bring it back. That's not happening. But the most fascinating thing did happen. They had a sort of update after about 18 months of not hearing anything about the Pershing Square Renew redesign contest, which was a secretive contest voted on in the shadows. No one knew anything about why the winner was picked, but it was Agence Terre from France. Take a trip to France? Why not? I'd like to take a trip to France, Richard. No?
I don't want to go to France.
No, we're staying in L.A.
I've been to France.
Yeah, I know. I've been to France, too. France is great. They have really nice parks. Don't look anything like the garbage that they're proposing for Pershing Square, because it turns out once Agence Terre isn't just entering a competition for a $50,000 prize, but looking at the actual park topography of Pershing Square, which suffered the addition in 1951-52 of an underground parking garage, which did not, contrary to the opinion of some people involved in the park restoration project, raise the level of the park. That actually didn't happen until the 1990s. Kind of weird that I know more about the park than the people who are being paid to redesign it, but maybe not. The topography is such that apparently their idea for an LED light portico to block out the eastern portion of the facade surrounding the park, the jewelry building, which, you know, it's postmodern, it's not so beautiful, it certainly isn't the most beautiful of the three surrounding sides of the park. Now, can't put the LED light panel there because of the weight needed and the parking garage below and the notion of peeling back some elements. No, the only place the LED light portico can go is in front of the Biltmore. That's stupid. Don't do that. So here we are. There's no money to actually redesign Pershing Square. The public has asked for John Parkinson's redesign. very much the most popular of the proposals, if you count people who signed petitions versus people who voted online. Not that that counted for anything in the redesign competition, but the councilman has his ideas and he gets to go. I don't know if he went to France, but he was talking about going to the Scandinavian countries at the event where he presented, you know, the updates. So, Moose the Cocoa was good. It's sad. Meanwhile, as I said, elements of the Legareta and Olin Park are being demolished, which is frustrating because, you know, it's actually a fairly functional park. But not so much when, for instance, you take the water feature and build a platform across it and put chairs on it. The chairs are supposed to surround the water feature, but no. It's really, really sad. What do you think, honey?
I think we need to keep moving, and you need to talk about the Zev Yaroslavsky editorial about Television City.
Oh, yeah, that was great. So we've been promoting the notion of William Pereira's Architecture in Peril, the great architect, the city planner, the person who was on the cover of Time in the 1963 as one of the most iconic visionaries of the New West. All of these massive compounds that he developed are in danger because, of course, they're on incredibly valuable land. Land that is valuable because people from all over the world are investing in the redevelopment of Los Angeles because this is a great place to park your money if, for instance, you've stolen it from the people. Oh, did I say that? Well, in any case, here we are. There have been a bunch of Pereira projects in the crosshairs. We've tried to stay on top of as many of them as we can. We've been hoping that the LA Conservancy would make a statement about one or another. And finally, to everyone's shock and delight, perhaps, when it was announced that CBS Television City, to the north of the original Farmers Market in the Fairfax District, was on the chopping block, on the market, the Conservancy came out and actually hired some of the people who know this stuff best, like Alan Hess, to write a landmarking nomination, which will be submitted shortly. And they got Zev Yaroslavsky, former supervisor and councilman, to write an op-ed for the Times, talking about how important it is to retain this building, both for its architectural significance — not even building, it's a compound — its architectural significance, its cultural significance, and this is, I think, most important and something to really bear in mind when we're looking at all of these projects that are happening, because developers from out of the country are coming in with massive amounts of money that they just want to plant here. The most important thing about preserving CBS Television City is it is a place where, for generations, since the early 1950s, high-paying professional Los Angeles jobs have been based. And that's something that our politicians and planners should be preserving, not enabling people from other countries to knock things down and clear-cut and just make Airbnbs. So it's really interesting that finally there's a Pereira project that has gotten onto the more mainstream preservation radar. I'm glad of it. I'm glad Zev is speaking up. And boy, if you want to see some people who are from Redlands talking really nasty about what Zev Yaroslavsky and the Conservancy think, hang out in the comments section of blogs, or don't.
Okay, Kim. So we've had. It's interesting. Our next watch train is sort of everything comes full circle. So now Bunker Hill. We talk a lot about Bunker Hill, about old Bunker Hill, pre redevelopment project circa 1960. But now, a 1983 Lawrence Halpern designed atrium at the former Crocker Court. Now, Wells Fargo Tower has been remodeled beyond recognition.
Well, I wouldn't say it's been remodeled. I mean, there's no modeling done. They just gutted it.
Okay. I was being polite.
You're being polite. It was kind of shocking because, December 31st was the last day of the Lawrence Halpern exhibition at the A&D Museum. They didn't organize it. It was touring, but, you know, it's kind of a big deal that the Halpern show comes here. The Conservancy recognized this and organized a number of walking tours of Halpern landscapes up on Bunker Hill. And there's four of them, and they actually integrate and interact. And if you care about this sort of thing, you can go up on Bunker Hill and explore these postmodernist landscapes that are meant to enliven and socialize and bring character and art to what is, you know, very much a cookie-cutter, ready-made urbanism, the redevelopment project of Bunker Hill, which is considered one of the great failures of America's redevelopment age because, you know, they clear-cut this wonderful integrated Victorian neighborhood, which was a mix of businesses and low-income housing, mixed use, people of all ages and races, and everyone looked after each other, and 9,000 people lived up there. It was the biggest eminent domain clearance in American history, and then no one actually wanted to do anything up on the hill except at the north side where Buffy Chandler and her friends wanted to have a music center. So, you know, the fact that anything got built up there and that some of the things that got built actually worked as public space were really special. And yet, Brookfield Properties, who, you know, they're enormous, they're New York-based.
Zuccotti Park.
Yeah, yeah, they're the ones who threw people out of what was supposed to be the public space that was paid for with public dollars, Zuccotti Park, the founding of the Occupy movement, which, you know, was a lot of fun while it lasted. I liked the free libraries. Brookfield just gutted this site, and no one knew about it. So the interesting thing is that we found out about it because Robert Peterson, who's a podcaster, happened to be dropping his kid off for preschool in the site and said, "What is going on here?" And someone, one of the guards said, "Oh yeah, we're redeveloping, we're changing it, it's going to be better," and tipped us off over at the LA Historic, the LA History Happenings Facebook group, where we had gotten tipped off a month earlier about the demolition of Vermonica. So it's become a really great tip line. So, you know, we put the word out. We heard from people involved in the A&D exhibition, from the Cultural Landscape Foundation. Right. We heard from the Conservancy. No one knew anything about it. Everyone was completely aghast, especially with the exhibition still ongoing. And then Curbed followed up on an Architects newspaper article about it. And Curbed got a quote from Brookfield. And it sort of sounded like maybe Brookfield thought it was all okay. Now, what's going on? It's really strange. This is a CRA site. The CRAs were dissolved by our governor, Jerry Brown, and there's supposed to be people in the city of Los Angeles, either in the successor agency or the planning department, overseeing all of these CRA contracts. This is the fourth example of public art or public space on Bunker Hill that has gone either missing or been destroyed in very, very recent months. It's not okay. We paid for this stuff. The CRA successor agency has to get its act together. The city planning department has to get its act together. It's not okay. If this was permitted, which we're hearing rumors of, why didn't the Conservancy know about it? Why? No, come on. Why is Brookfield telling Curbed we're consulting with experts? What experts? The people who curated the exhibition didn't know anything about it, neither did the Conservancy, and no one in the public knew anything about it. That's messed up, man.
So this is really complicated, and
shouldn't be.
It's a part of the Los Angeles city bureaucracy, so it's inherently complicated and unclear. And so we're going to keep you posted on this. Okay, we're doing our best to get some answers. Okay.
Okay. Here's the thing. This isn't fair. It is not fair that I have to get emotionally invested in a postmodern landscape from 1983. Come on, people. Okay. There are other people to worry about this stuff.
Okay, Kim. We have to keep moving. We have to keep moving. Wallace Berry.
The guy was a son of a bitch.
Yes, he was.
Come on. We love Joan Crawford. But he had a beautiful house that William Kessling built for him down in the Fairfax District. Streamlined, modern, machine age, green and white, sexiest effing house you've ever seen in your life. Sold for an appropriate price of upwards of $1.5 million because it's a really sexy house, not landmarked. And some knucklehead from Beverly Hills also bought the apartment building next door and plans to clear-cut the entire thing and put in a bunch of condos. This is really troubling. Preservationists are aghast. "This cannot stand, man," to quote the cranky preservationist. You know, there's a limited number of these types of properties. They are uniquely Southern California. A movie star house built in the streamlined modern style by the master of the streamlined modern. The notion of demolishing it for some generic condos is actually greedy and disgusting and inappropriate. And I think that the more that we can fight this sort of completely inappropriate clear-cutting in the city of L.A., although, to the developer's credit, at least he lives locally, the more we can discourage this kind of thing. Unfortunately, the planning department, with the small lot ordinance, is making this sort of thing super easy, and that needs to change, too. because we have a homeless crisis in the city, and some of those homeless people might actually be losing really amazing streamlined modern houses.
Okay, Kim, we're almost there. You get to talk about Vermonica. This is where we talk about Vermonica. We were just there. Unlike everything else, the last six items, this is actually has a positive end note.
Everything has a positive end note. We bellyache because we care, and then things get better, usually. Hey, the number one item on the preservation list this year is Angel's Flight, and our petition saved Angel's Flight. So you know what? Listen, people, it's worth it. You can get really upset, but as long as you understand the process and who to talk to and how to shape the narrative, you can change things. Vermonica, the first tip-off that we got of a preservation crisis in the holiday season this year through the LA History Happenings Facebook group, hang out, maybe you'll learn something, was someone who said, what happened to Vermonica, that installation of historic LA streetlights in the parking lot outside the Staples at Vermont and Santa Monica? Vermonica by Sheila Klein, a piece that was created in 1993 as a memorial for the LA riots. Well, what happened, it turns out, is that people from the mini mall there reached out to the Office of Street Lighting Services, the Bureau, and said, hey, we're going to be doing some work on the parking lot. Although, interestingly, we were just there. We didn't see any work that had gone on. But they were told, got to move a couple of those streetlights, which would mean dismantling the artwork. The response of the Bureau of Street Lighting was, well, we own those streetlights. They've been there 24 years longer than they were supposed to for the short-term public-private partnership. Let's just get them out of there. And so, with a small crew, they did so right before Thanksgiving. And they moved them just a couple blocks away down to their office next to the yard where they maintain all of the historic lights.
Cutting down a bunch of trees.
They cut down a bunch of trees in their yard. They reinstalled the light poles. I'm not going to say they reinstalled Vermonica. And it's really important that the public understand that if they go over to the Bureau of Street Lighting Services, which is basically at Virgil and Santa Monica, and look at them in front of the building in that sort of soft U shape, that's not Vermonica. An artist created Vermonica in a site-specific location, a location that was actually heavily impacted by the LA riots. It's where Holitron was, an electronics store that was defended by its Korean-American owners with heavy machine gun fire. So that's what Vermonica was about. Vermonica is not about moving the streetlights down the block, because maybe or maybe not they're going to work on the driveways and the asphalt. So the good thing is Sheila Klein is a really agreeable person who loves this work of art, and although she's upset that it was moved without her permission, which is a complete violation of her artist rights, she's willing to come to the table with the city of LA. We were at the first of these meetings. Richard, you facilitated that meeting. I want to thank you for doing that, because everyone was super upset, and you knew who to call and try to fix this.
And that's what I do.
That's what you do. And the end result is, Sheila Klein is in discussions with the mayor's office about what happened, how it can be made into a positive thing.
Turn the frown upside down.
Turn the frown upside down. Get Vermonica reinstalled somewhere using its pieces, which are currently stored, not Vermonica, in front of the Bureau of Street Lighting Services, and most importantly, get a dialogue going about artist rights and public art and what needs to happen in the future so that if anything like this ever gets on the radar of another division of the city, the response isn't like, let's get some guys over there and move that stuff. It's, art actually needs to be treated differently. Let's reach out to someone who has some sensitivity and make sure that we're doing this right.
And call the artist.
Call the artist, who is called out by name on the website of the Bureau of Street Services because you're so proud of Vermonica. Oh, we didn't know if she was still around. Her URL is SheilaKlein.com. So, happily, Richard, you asked the right questions. That was our Thanksgiving weekend. Happily, we don't really celebrate the mainstream holidays. We celebrate Preservation Day every day.
Yeah, we just work, Kim.
It shows. You forgot an item, though.
That's okay. We have one more. 18 months ago, the Vandy Camp's windmill was restored in Arcadia. Yeah, the Vandy Camps in Arcadia. It's now a Denny's. This was 18 months ago, the fruits of a 4-year campaign to restore the Vandy Camps one meal came to fruition. The incredible effort by Denny's, the city of Arcadia, the sign contractor, and I'm sorry to say that about a week ago, just after Christmas, just that week between Christmas and New Year's, the windmill collapsed, fell off its mount, and damaged the
restaurant's still closed, Richard. The blade fell through the roof.
Yeah, it's not good.
But really embarrassing.
But we were there like 2 days before it happened, and so you took a photo of it, and you like got on the news.
Yeah, Fox News showed our video of it spinning on Christmas Eve. Hey, you know what? preservation is great. You know what's even better than preservation is maintenance. I'm sorry. It's so embarrassing for everyone involved. And Denny's has yet to make a statement what went wrong and what they plan to do about it. They were certainly very forthcoming 18 months to the day before it collapsed when they launched the thing. Noon on the hottest day of the summer. Why couldn't they have launched it at 9 in the morning or in the evening because the darn thing's illuminated? But no, we sat out there in the heat. I'm glad we were there, especially under the circumstances. And they're like, oh, we didn't think this was going to cost so much. It was $100,000. Well, you got a lot of good publicity, 18 months of people driving by and being happy, and now the blade has fallen through the roof and the restaurant is closed. Please bring it back. And when you do, tighten the nut.
Yeah, okay. All right, so Kim, we've got to start to get to the interviews, and to get to the interviews, we have to work through just a few short items about upcoming events. We need to talk about Brad's guest-hosted bus tour, which is the subject of his interview. We need to talk about Nathan's salon. We have to talk about we'll just get to it. All right,
do not do it that way, and I'll just do it this way. Okay, I see. I have a list here. Well, why don't I go through it? You know. We're back in the basement of Grand Central Market for our monthly, except for November and December, Lava Sunday Salon. It starts with a lecture, and it's all about the cultural history and architecture of Southern California. And then we go outside and walk around downtown, and it's always a lot of fun. If you want to hang out with people who are nerdy about architecture and history, and if you've made it this far, guys, I'm afraid to tell you, you are. Yeah, that or you're hate listening, in which case, go back to Redlands. I love Redlands. We're going to Redlands. So join us for the Lava Sunday Salon. It's free with RSVP. We're so excited. Nathan Marsak, our dear, dear friend, will be giving his inaugural salon again this year. He's the last person. Well, you know, he's the last person we named the Visionary of the Year because we realized it was kind of bad luck. I don't know. So it's a lot of work. He's the Visionary of the Year for the foreseeable. So he comes out in January. He is. And he's going to talk about the aesthetics of Bunker Hill and how the Munsters helped ensure that the Victorians would be demolished. So that'll be the last Sunday of the month. RSVP. Join us. Do tell your friends. We'd love to see you. Also, we have on the calendar Brad Schreiber's second bus tour. It was supposed to be a one-off during our 10th anniversary, but it was so much fun, sold out, more people want to do it, and now we have Detective Mike Digby joining us with a whole new facet of this incredibly bizarre story of turning criminals in the California correctional system into revolutionary informants and giant troublemakers. So it's called 48 Hours in South LA. You're not going to be on the bus for 48 hours. It's only four. It's February 10th. That's my birthday week. Get on the bus. We'd love to have you. It's going to be a lot of fun. Patty Hearst might show up. Probably not. We have a forensic science seminar coming up March 4th. It's on wrongful convictions and exonerations, which has never been more important. The New York Times just published an op-ed about the need for the Supreme Court to actually take on the matter of the death penalty because it is so inequitable and because odds are innocent people are being executed. You'll learn from the seminar when we're going to meet some of the exonerees and the attorneys who worked with them. You're going to learn about cases where people who were factually innocent, who are completely uninvolved. Nonetheless, lawyers and prosecutors are able to spin reality and convince a bunch, well, if you've ever been on a jury, this shouldn't surprise you, but convince a bunch of jurors that someone was involved in something incredibly heinous and needs to be punished with perhaps life in prison or even the death penalty. You'll learn a lot about how this works, and that's on March 4th at Cal State LA. It's not a bus tour. We do these on a quarterly fashion, and it's fundraisers for the Criminalistics Department of Cal State LA. Also coming up in the special events category, our second and completely all new, well, it's about 80% all new, Desert Visionaries 2 tour of the Antelope Valley. Llano del Rio, different Llano del Rio sites, different insights, new research. St. Andrew's Monastery, which, if you didn't know, creates some really wonderful big-eyed mid-century modern pottery. That is their craft, and they have a beautiful site up there. We're going to have a lovely lunch with the monks and take a tour. We'll be going to the Angeles Crest Creamery to walk with the goats. And yes, there are baby goats in their mother goat's tummies right now who are pawing their little hooves. They can't wait to get out and walk with you because they're going to be born by March 17th. And we'll also be going back to Aldous Huxley's Pear Blossom Ranch. It's an all-day trip looking at visionary creative people in the Antelope Valley. So that is that. That's some upcoming tours.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Kim. Okay. Okay, here we are.
Can you tell I'm excited about the baby goats? I'm really excited. I love goats.
The goats, Gloria's goats, are super cute. Gloria's totally awesome. Gloria runs Angela's Crest Creamery. Okay, so let's get to the interviews. So let's take a deep breath. Pranayama, right? Okay, so interviews. First interview is with Brad, so we'll introduce him last. Second interview is with Linda, so we'll introduce her and her son Adam now. Okay, so second interview, Linda Jensen, Adam Wadlow. Okay, they are awesome because they have won for the second time in 5 years at the Arcadia Beautiful Christmas Decoration Award.
The only reason it's the second time in 5 years is they're disqualified for 4 years because once you win, they're like, you got to take a break and let someone else win. Okay.
So what this interview is going to do, just to get everyone ready. So what Adam's going to do is he's going to create and delineate a typography of decorating your lawn with Christmas ornaments. And it's really dead serious. And he's incredibly gifted. And I just, you know, I knew this was going to be amazing going into it. And we sat down, we got some really good questions, but it was like so much better than I expected.
Right. I mean, you may be wondering, oh, well, why didn't you rush a podcast episode out before Christmas so people could hear this?
No.
Christmas, you're hanging out with your family or loved ones if you have any. You're eating really heavy, starchy food. You're in no position to take this information in because if you're serious about stepping up to the plate and doing this yourself, you need to have your wits about you. In fact, if you're still feeling a little bit of a food coma from the holidays, wait and don't listen to this interview. Wait a few days. When you listen to it, it might inspire you. It might change your life. You might win a beautification contest.
Okay.
Yes.
Thoughts have wings. So it's a great interview, and so I'm looking forward to this. And also, now in the immediate aftermath of the Christmas holidays, that's when you want to go out and look for all your Christmas ornaments. This is the time. This.
All the limited edition stuff's on sale, 20% of regular price. It's the time. Go and stock up. Get ready.
But leave some for Linda.
Are you kidding? Linda already got hers.
Okay, so our first interview, which we're going to get to in seconds. Our first interview is with author Brad Schreiber. Brad is our dear friend. It's just so great to work with Brad. This is the second year doing the bus tour about the Symbionese Liberation Army. The denouement of this tour, which is just a small subsection of his book about the Symbionese Liberation Army. The denouement of this bus tour in South Los Angeles is the shootout site at East 54th Street. And that'll be the last stop. And that's this 4-hour tour really leads up to this bunch of threads woven together and ending in this. We're so excited. This is a great interview. He's a super interesting guy. He's done crime labs with us. He did one on his book. He's done one on this book, and he's done one on his book Death in Paradise about the coroner. And I suspect there may be more in store because we're John Cady's at the coroner's office. All right, so let's, without any further introduction, get to our interview with author Brad Schreiber. Brad, I'm here with you. We're sitting at a cafe next door to Dupar's. We're in Studio City. Dupar's is closing. Dupar's has nothing to do with this interview.
It actually does.
Okay, well, good. We'll get to that.
I'm going to make it so.
So, Brad, I want you...
No matter how extraneous it may seem.
So we're at Studio City. I want you to properly introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Brad Schreiber, generally a writer in all media and a producer, and it's been my great pleasure to run a Symbionese Liberation Army bus tour through Richard and Kim's Esoteric, as well as to do crime lab lectures at Cal State LA's Criminalistics Department for Richard and Kim's Los Angeles Visionaries Association.
Thank you, Brad. That was a very nice introduction. Thank you. So we're here. We're here in Studio City, and we're here to talk about this bus tour. I want you to tell us the proper title of the bus tour.
Well, my understanding, unless it's changed, is 48 hours in South Los Angeles.
Yes.
And there's more to the title, isn't there? I forget what you were using. But the reason that Richard came up with that title, and it's so apropos that even as a control freak, I haven't attempted to change it, is because it's perfect. 48 hours is the period of time that Patty Hearst and the members of the Symbionese Liberation Army in 1974 spent crucial moments in Los Angeles that resulted in the robbery of a sporting goods store in Inglewood and the largest shootout in United States history that involved over 500 officers, wiped out a supposed left-wing group that had kidnapped heiress Patricia Hearst, and in actuality was a blown police intelligence operation. And so that's why 48 hours in South LA, which we used to call South Central.
Perfect. And this is based on a book you've written, Revolution's End. So tell us, so this bus tour is a subset. We've basically just taken a 48-hour slice of the narrative of this book of yours and made a bus tour about it. So now tell us about your book, Revolution's End.
Well, thank you. The full title of which is Revolution's End, The Patty Hearst Kidnapping, Mind Control, and the secret history of Donald DeFries and the SLA. The SLA, again, Symbionese Liberation Army. I wrote the book because I knew a lot about Donald DeFries, the snitch who set up Black Panthers in South L.A. for arrest, who was then sent to jail because he was messing up and the LAPD could not run him anymore as an informant, suffered behavior modification experimentation at Vacaville Prison run by a CIA program, and then was offered the ability to escape and set up an all-white supposed radical left group that would then behave improperly and thus destroy the reputation of the Black Panthers and white radicals in the left, with San Francisco Bay Area being the center of the radical movement in 1974.
Okay, that was a lot, so let's take a breath. So you've just, this book is about a lot of things. Several of which people is not in the public consciousness. The conjugal visits between Patty Hearst under an alias and DeFree, many things. What I want to do though is I want to stay on this bus tour. I want you, let's talk about the stop, about the nice kid that they buy the car from. So let's just, because I want to keep. So this tour, we're going to drive around South Los Angeles in this tour and talk about this amazing 48-hour narrative that leads up to the shootout. And, of course, the last stop on the tour is West 54th Street. But tell us about this nice young kid
it's like near Lawndale.
Yeah, it's near Lawndale. Tell us about this nice kid that they buy the car from.
Hawthorne area. So one of the strange things that happened in the 48 hours that the SLA basically interacted with law enforcement, and then six people were wiped out, and we'll talk about that in a minute, is that Patty Hearst was with two other members of the SLA, Bill and Emily Harris. And they kept stealing cars so they would not be caught by law enforcement. At one point, they looked in a local paper and saw that someone was selling a used car cheaply. Turns out it's a 17-year-old kid who recognizes, after he's kidnapped, that he's in the car with America's number one wanted criminal, heiress Patricia Hearst. And he's excited. He's delighted. And they actually like this kid, and they spend many hours with him. They steal another car. They're up in the hills. Well, one of the great things we did on the first, and Richard, you didn't say we've already had one of these SLA bus tours, which was such a delight to run, I cannot tell you. We went to the house where this 17-year-old boy was kidnapped while trying to sell his car to the SLA, befriends them. They get him back home unharmed.
In time, was he in time for his baseball game?
And that's right. The next day, his team wins the county high school baseball championship. And he was at first base, and he couldn't have been happier, except that he wanted to tell everybody that he'd been hanging out with Patty Hearst.
All right, so we don't want to give the tour away. I just put some highlights. That's good. We're going to stop at the former location of Mel's Sporting Goods, and this was and this is interesting because the Mel's Sporting Goods. Why don't you quickly sketch out the scene that happens at Mel's Sporting Goods?
Well, one of the scenes on the bus tour that you'll experience is seeing the former site of Mel's Sporting Goods, where Bill and Emily Harris were buying goods, mostly clothing, from the store, and then Bill Harris, in his brilliance, decided to steal a bandolier and shoved it up his sleeve. Again, this is where youth comes in. This is a tour about young, impetuous people. A 19-year-old kid who's studying criminalistics and is a security guard sees Bill Harris stealing the bandolier and basically takes handcuffs and tries to stop him. Bill Harris wrestles the gun away from the kid. Other people are coming out of the store to try and arrest Bill and Emily Harris. And the only reason they don't arrest him is because Patricia Hearst opens fire with a semi-automatic carbine across Inglewood Boulevard. Oh, excuse me, Crenshaw Boulevard. And 27 .30 caliber bullets miraculously hit no one and decimate the front of the store. And you'll see that in the immediate escape area afterwards.
Perfect. Okay. And then, of course, the last stop on this tour is West 54th Street. So I think you... East 54th Street. Thank you. I'm sorry. East 54th Street. I think you mentioned this... I think we'll deal with the shootout at the end. Okay? I think that the shootout poses a number of good questions for the city and the country, and let's get back to that. What I want to ask you is, you do events all the time. You're a great speaker. You get out there. I want you to tell us how giving a bus tour about your book is different than, say, giving a reading at Vroman's or
There is an incredible, palpable excitement when you go to the locations that are in your nonfiction writing. So not only do Richard and Kim have a great setup with slides and video clips on screens within the bus, and you're at the location, and you have me on mic, you have special guest writers, the LA Times or police people, who also are on the bus giving more narrative. Not only is that different from a bookstore, but the interaction. It's a different interaction when somebody goes up and buys your book and it has 30 seconds with you in a line, versus walking in the location and three people are walking along with you, casually going, so what happened at this house, and how did you find out about it, and what else is in your mind that's not in the book? And you have the time, while you're walking through the physical space, to interact with these people, many of whom are incredibly sharp people and historians, so they ask much better questions than the people in the media, I'm sorry to say.
Don't be sorry. And also, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but you know, we have really good coffee breaks, and there's really something to be said for 50 people walking through a neighborhood. And really, it's really something else. So I want to jump into the deep end here, Brad. We talked about sort of the three adjectives that you use to describe this book. Illegal, immoral, and effective. Okay? Work backwards. Get us to some people, get us to some actions which are central to the narrative in Revolution's End, that where these three adjectives come from. Illegal, immoral, effective.
Well, you made a great point before we started taping, and that is that America had such a law and order mentality that you had Richard M. Nixon, who is possibly clinically paranoid, which is actually probably helpful for politicians, but incredibly repressive. Then you had, you know, Ronald Reagan, governor of California, and both their attorneys general were incredibly militant people. So you add that with the CIA and the LAPD intelligence angles in this book, it's just so mind-boggling. You have the feeling of an America where the law is never an impediment to the Republic and the state of California as well, breaking any law they need to in order to get intelligence. But also you have to recognize that there was talk of revolution. And the Black Panthers and white radicals were talking about overthrowing the government, which of course in America, as a country as powerful as America, is absurd. But you can imagine how much more militant it made Reagan and Nixon.
Perfect. I know I'm not going to have you talk about the discoveries, the forensic discoveries you've made in this podcast. We talk about it on the tour. Kim would be mad at me if I had you give that away. But there, I can assure you, I can assure everyone listening, Brad has uncovered some really amazing information. And also for this tour, the second time we're doing it, we're going to have retired detective, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, Arson Division, Mike Digby on the bus talking about, I guess, so Mike's going to sort of pick up the thread. So this, the tour and the narrative explicitly is 48 hours around the shootout. And then Mike's going to sort of carry forward the narrative, looking ahead, what happens to the SLA in the aftermath of all of this, and how eventually, 20 years later, charges are brought against them. So that's going to be really fantastic, and we love Mike. What I want you to do, excuse me, what I want you to do to end this interview is I want you to answer the question, what is the significance of the shootout, the denouement of this tour, of your book and this tour? What is the significance to Los Angeles of the shootout and to the nation?
I think people who go on this esoteric bus tour and wind up at East 54th and Compton, where the shootout and fire occurred, are going to be at a spot where all U.S. history was changed. Okay, not just L.A. County history, and not just the biggest shootout in history, but where all political history changed, and here's why I say it. You're going to learn on this tour that after almost an hour and 40 minutes of shooting on live television, broadcast on all three major networks, first time that happened, and the introduction for the first time to American audiences of SWAT teams, which then exponentially changed all police departments and the militarization. In addition to that, this was a supposed radical group, which your bus tour attendees will learn was basically set up to discredit the left. So all political history changed after the shootout and fire on live TV, with the SWAT being introduced to America, because it destroyed any legitimacy of the new left, including people who are generally law-abiding. Not just the weathermen who were bombing buildings, the perceptions of people about the new left and the things that they wanted to change in America. So all that happened. And the last thing about this location, it's a secondary thing to those which are rather important, is that it was the first time that pooled coverage of a national event had ever happened on live TV in the United States. KNXT, the CBS affiliate, then, now KCBS, pooled coverage, and instantly everyone everywhere was watching this incredible show of power without really knowing the true story and the dark underbelly of what happened on East 54th Street, where you're going if you have any sense whatsoever.
Thank you. Okay, that was great. I encourage people to get on this bus. It's going to be a lot of fun. Brad, you're brilliant.
No, you. Oh. These guys, it's just a pleasure to work with you guys, as you know. And
take a second and tell everyone how brilliant Mike Digby is, because he's the real underdog in this tour, because he doesn't have as large a role, obviously, as you.
Well, all the people I meet through you and Kim are pretty damn brilliant. Mike Digby has written the book on Los Angeles's bombs, bombers, and bombings as maybe the foremost bomb technician in the world, admittedly retired. But they'd fly him out to Scotland Yard, and they'd fly him out, you know, for Mossad in Israel. So you got to know that he's a brilliant guy. He was the top of his trade. And he understands, as you said, what happens after East 54th Street when Patty Hearst is on the lam and there are other bank robberies and other bombings. And he is the perfect guy to fill people in on the bus about that.
Perfect. Okay, so we're going to wrap this up. I want to thank you. I want you to remind everyone your book's name.
It's Revolution's End. The subtitle, you don't need to memorize, and in fact, it'll be impossible to memorize, is The Patty Hearst Kidnapping, Mind Control, and The Secret History of Donald DeFries and the SLA, Revolution's End. Thank you so much, Richard.
Brad, thank you. We'll see you Saturday, February 10th, for 48 hours in South Los Angeles.
I'll be there, and you better be too.
My name is Alan Hess. I'm here in the Seaview Track in Palos Verdes, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Linda, Adam, I'm here with you at your house in Arcadia. I want you both to introduce yourself, and then Adam, you're gonna hone us in just a little bit more. So, Linda, you first. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Linda.
Okay, and Adam.
Linda is my mom. I'm Adam. Linda's my mom here with me, and my name is Adam, and I am the man who sets up all of this this craziness here. And Linda, my mom, is the woman who does all the great hunting and finding these items at local swap meets. And so, she brings them home, and I plug them in and I set them up.
All right, and we are talking about a decorated lawn and complete, actually, environment around your house, which just won the award, a second award, 2013. You won the first award from... Right, and this just about a month ago, you were awarded, again, 2017, the award for Best Holiday Decorations. So one of you, you're going to take turns. Adam, you're going to start. Tell us, because this is a podcast and we can only hear it, tell us what this award-winning lawn design looks like.
Well, I think the simplest way to describe our property is that we specialize in blow mold figures in particular. We have, there are many homes nowadays that use the modern LED lights, which, I'll be honest, I think I have many desirable qualities about them. A, their energy efficiency, and B, you can create some really neat cold effects, etc. But we love that warm effect of the blow mold figures and the old style lights. And so we have amassed quite a collection over the years of blow mold figures. I'm going to put the number somewhere around 70. That's 70, and that is not including all other types of decorations that we have, either be wooden or plastic or other types of light up. That's just simply our blow mold figures that we have alone on the property.
Okay, great. So let's hone in. So we're standing on your street, your undisclosed street, and we're looking at the sea of blow mold Santas. Linda, I'm going to have you come in because I notice out on the edge there's a snowman with a cap and a scarf. And I was hoping you could talk about that, because as I know, Adam mentioned, it has a really interesting provenance.
Which one are we talking about?
You might just have to clarify a little bit for us which particular piece you're talking about.
The one of six that was given to the sisters.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, he's talking about the plywood, the snowman back there leaning against a tree. Tell him about your.
About 20 years ago, my sister Judy gave our mother and each one of her siblings one of the wooden decorations, and we have the large snowman. And I'm sorry to say that my mom's and all my other siblings were stolen. Luckily, ours was not over the years. But yeah, it means a lot to me because probably about 20 years ago I got that.
Fantastic. And so, you know, the joke of what just happened is that I said the snowman, and there are, of course, like 17 snowmen.
You got me. That's exactly. I'm focusing on the 14 in front of me. Right. I wasn't thinking
so,
about it.
So, Linda, let's focus on you for a minute. What is the range of age of these decorations? I know that every year you actively look for decorations, but I also know we were in your house and you started pointing out stuff that you got when you were a teenager. So it's been a minute or two that you've been collecting. Do you want to just sort of give a scale and scope of your collection of Christmas ornaments?
Probably, I have several that I got when I was a child and a teenager. And a lot of them are from the 40s, 50s, 60s. And then over the years, going to vintage flea markets and thrift stores, you know, looking, I like the old ones, so trying to find the old ones. And then the blow mold ones are getting harder and harder to find. And it used to be easy for me to go to the flea markets and find what I wanted, but now there's quite the competition of people racing through and buying them. And I don't know if they're just buying them to sell on eBay or whatever, right, or for their own yards. So, it's getting harder and harder.
Okay, and let me interrupt you. Let's describe to us when you say a blow mold, or maybe Adam, you want to do this. Adam, describe to us what a blow mold is.
Well, I absolutely want to, but I just want to interject one thing regarding what my mother was just speaking about regarding her legacy of collecting, because she's far too modest and doesn't fully touch on the breadth and the depth of her collecting. Not only of Christmas items and these amazing blow mold figures, but pottery, artwork, jewelry, crystal perfume bottles. There are many, many collections that throughout the years come out that replace so many of the holiday decorations. And so she has been dedicated for a number of years, both, like she said, antique malls, the local swap meets in the Los Angeles area, such as PCC and Long Beach.
Yeah.
But I think one question that wasn't answered is that some of these particular outdoor figures, I would say range, in some cases, these carolers could be the 1950s, that row of four, maybe, 60s, all the way up to present. But to maintain them for that many years because of the damage that the sun does to them and the heat and storing them, it really is kind of an accomplishment to maintain and be able to put out each year some that are that old.
Okay, good. And hold that thought of maintenance, because we're going to come to that. I want to ask you, Adam, and we talked about this, okay, I'm going to ask you two questions, and they're both related, and you're going to answer it together. So, what is the major challenge you face with your lawn for decoration, and what is your sort of modus operandi of how you fill this space with the challenges inherent to the space?
Okay. Well, I also want to say real fast, a blow mold figure is a simple method of production the way these were made. It was an actual mold made of metal in which hot plastic was injected under compressed air. Boom, you got a figure. That's what a blow mold figure is. My biggest challenge on this lawn, it has to be wind. It definitely would have to be contesting with the wind every December. I learn more and more lessons each year that go by, and some figures have bricks in them or a piece of block of lead or a piece of steel. Others have stakes, you know, which, you know, I can stake right directly down into the lawn. The wind will expose any weaknesses that you have. And as far as my modus operandi, so to speak, regarding the property and the way I set up this layout, I am working within the constrictions of the shape of the property itself. Our property is a long, deep property. We do not have a tremendous amount of frontage. So I'm working on a longer, deeper property. So we don't not only have the front of the property lit, we have a space in both in between. There's two houses in between. And then all the way in the distance, which is something I really enjoy. It pulls your eye all the way to the very back of a long driveway to a massive nativity scene that we have. So working with the diameters of the property itself, you know.
Of course. Well, we're going to get to Linda, right? You anticipate us. Power supply. Right. Okay. So power supply. Yes. So Adam, that begs the question. It's 2017. This is supposed to be a country correctly obsessed with being green and energy conscious. Yes, and, of course, so LEDs, we're supposed to just, you know, say LED and genuflect. When it comes to Christmas decorations, do you like LED? And so let's just jump into that. Let's talk about lamps.
LEDs head on. I'll confront LEDs head on. They're amazing technology. If I have a flashlight or I want to put a decorative light in my cabinet or certain cabinetry applications, they're brilliant. They're brilliant. In terms of headlights these days, they're absolutely blinding. And in terms of Christmas lights, to me, they are overall cold in their appearance. One cannot deny the energy efficiency. I've spoke with a number of people with Christmas layouts that tell me they saw dramatic decreases. But you know what? To me, they also saw dramatic decreases in the warmth and overall 1950s, 60s Norman Rockwell glow, to me, that I like the look that I want to see. So to me, yes, there is a considerable expense in cost increase. You see, we're both laughing here, and it is substantial because not only do we have the blow mold figures, but you'll notice that we use the classic C9 Christmas bulb that any of the baby boomers, anybody from those generations knows. This was the definitive Americana bulb that you had on your house, and to me, it's Christmas. And yes, they draw juice, and so, yeah, that brings us to circuit breakers and brings us to plugging in the entire layout. I have to be strategic. I have to, you know, learn my limits on each circuit and determine how much I can pull. We don't want any fires. We don't want anything like that. So I draw power. We have the two houses and a large garage, so I draw power from a number of different sources.
Perfect.
And I learn my lessons. You start tripping breakers if you have too much on one circuit, and you adjust accordingly.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So really this warmth that you get from the incandescent bulbs, this is really what you're looking at, I think, when you're talking about what yeah. Okay, so because I want to end up in the kitchen. I want to end up talking about the kitchen counter. Why don't we just walk down the path and you guys can point some stuff out.
I'd like to say, you know, we're talking so much about, you know, the warmth and the incandescence, but that said, contrast is a great thing. So, for example, we have a flamingo section, we have some of these candy canes with the dachshund, or you see that stag with the blinking lights. It adds contrast, you know, so that you have a little bit of movement. I don't like when properties have too much movement. Sometimes it's a little distracting, but a little bit of contrast. So,
This is the best podcast interview I've ever done in my entire life.
You got a talker in me. You got a talker in me.
This is the best topic in the world.
That's a good speaker.
You know, and then please direct your attention to the top of the chimney this year. This year we have four angels. And I think it's important for the purposes of this podcast to please understand that we also do a tremendous Halloween layout. So
We're going to get to that. Don't worry. Let's start walking.
All right.
we haven't even. Yeah, we're going to get. All right. So
tell
we're walking.
Flamingos,
right.
Tell
so
the
yeah.
About
okay. So we're standing in front of the flamingos, and let's get a little closer. Okay. They're very cute. So, Adam, why don't you describe the flamingos, and then we'll let your mom sort of talk about the backstory.
Well, it's a small flamingo section, and some of them would just be considered your average garden flamingo, nothing, you know, to write home about. But this past year, she found a couple, and they're both animatronic. They move. They both come forward and back. They have lit-up feet.
and the bodies are lit up with pink lights, and I think they're a really nice addition in the Christmas flamingo section.
Yeah. So, Linda, do you have anything to add about the flamingos? Like, what's their story?
Well, I was very excited. I bought the two animatronic ones not knowing they were going to move, so that was a very fun surprise when we got those home.
You should start an unpacking YouTube channel.
And so the other ones, I'd had those a while, and then found this bird a year ago. And then we have a peacock also.
For Arcadia.
We have that peacock, yeah. Yeah, sure. But...
I have the peacock.
Anyway.
All right, well, let's keep walking back to the Bat Hawk. We have the Nutcrackers here. We're passing some Nutcrackers.
You've got to have Nutcrackers, toy soldiers. It's an absolute must. So I just want to say in this front yard that we're walking past, in this front yard alone, combined with the fence on the front of our property, you probably have 30 blow mold figures alone just in this front yard. And that is not including the rest of the property. We'll now...
Right.
One new one that I got this year at the Pasadena City College Flea Market, which I love, is that moose on the porch in his clothes.
he's like a majorette moose.
I absolutely love him. And then we have Mr. and Mrs. Claus up there. I really like those. But it's quite a variety. Yeah, it's a good variety.
let's keep walking. Let's keep walking.
These are some classics. We have a Minnie, a Mickey, and a Goofy here, blow-mold figures. Yeah. These would definitely be considered some of the more desirable, more rare to find pieces.
And these are, what is their vintage, do you think? Are these recent?
What do you think, 1970s, early 80s on them?
I would think Minnie, Mickey, and we also have Goofy. Probably from the 70s or maybe the 80s. Yeah. Right. And they are very rare. Very rare, very, very hard to find. And I feel lucky to have them because when I see them now, they're very expensive.
All right.
We saw a new piece the other night at a home that we're going to be on the hunt for to accompany our Winnie the Pooh bear, which is a Tigger, which is another very rare blow mold piece, something that is not common at all.
Yeah.
Wow.
And see, for part of the hunt for me is to find economical ones,
right,
which is getting harder and harder.
Right, writing a check for $500 for a blow mold is just that's not the point.
To have many, most of them here that I paid hardly anything for.
She found one today, a very unique one, a smaller one, but it's a Santa Claus and it's one that I've never seen before. And it's just, you know, like she says, and I'm the same way, which I get from my mother. I'm a collector. Is just that thrill of the hunt, and not just like you say, writing it, you know, a huge check or, you know, when you find something, a real gem, and you get a screaming deal on it, I mean, it's exciting. That's a part of it too.
Yeah. So Linda, do you mind? I don't want you to show your whole hand, but you've just mentioned the Pasadena City College Flea Market. Do you want to just toss out people a bone or two of where they might find some good pickings on some waters that aren't too depleted?
Well, the two flea markets that I like to go to are the Long Beach Vintage Market and then PCC. I no longer go to the Rose Bowl anymore, just because of you have to pay a fortune to get in before 9.
Right.
I like to get there like at 6 or 7, and then a lot of the same dealers are there.
Right.
But this year, I watched a lot of people literally running at 6 in the morning to dealers and just grabbing up everything.
Right.
And luckily for me, I was only looking for some rare pieces this year because I already have enough Santas, enough snowman, enough all this. So trying to find some different ones, it was difficult. It used to be simple to get stuff, but I think more and more people are buying them up.
I think the gold line out to the gold line really driving up property values out here. And I've noticed a lot of Kim's favorite thrift stores.
Oh.
Are closing.
And the antique malls are closing, too. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's keep walking. Right. And so let's see. So we're halfway there. So I see a Santa and a reindeer.
This piece here, so as we're nearing kind of the center line of the property, this is one of our new pieces that she found this year. Really kind of neat. It's a Santa Claus in a sleigh with a small reindeer. And he's very similar to a set that we...
Which is kind of our holy grail. We've been looking for a long time the classic set where it's a Santa and the full eight reindeer, and you can stretch it between either a roof line or a pole that flies above the property. Yeah. And it's something that we've been looking for a long time. But he was kind of a neat addition. He's sort of a small little version of it, mounted on a fence here next to a trumpeting angel.
I love it. So the Santa and a full suite of reindeer.
That's the
holy grail.
The full flying piece that you can string across your property, like you see, you know, like he's flying through the sky. And you can sometimes find part of the piece, so you might find one or two reindeer, but they're out there. But to find that full set is something that, yeah, I would say for us is at the top of our list.
Okay, well, just keep that in your meditations. Just focus on that. I know Linda's going to deliver. I know. She's got the gift. Okay, so now we're getting a little farther back.
Sure.
And we can start to hear the parrots.
Will you? Yes, you can hear that we do have birds at this residence. So we're coming back toward the what we call the main house on this property. Mm-hmm. And you know, another assortment of decorations in this this lawn here. You know, once again, like I said, long, skinny property.
Right.
So we're trying to, you know, decorate each of these spaces as you move up the driveway.
All right. Let's see. We have sort of, this is not a set, but we have a Santa in a sleigh with a reindeer, and this is this plastic blow mold.
This would be another older figure right here. Yeah. This would be a classic one a lot of people would be familiar with. It's a Santa. He's on a sleigh, and he's kind of waving up into the sky. And originally, his set, he would have been, I'm sure, accompanied at one point with a matching set of reindeer, most likely, that went with him. I think, actually, in fact, if you watch the movie National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, the set that Chevy Chase explodes with anger, and he starts beating them all up and chopping at their horns. I'm pretty sure that is the set of reindeer that would have gone with this particular sleigh right here. So
good eye, good eye.
When I, you know, whenever I see a blow mold figure, my eyes pop out.
Before we go in the kitchen, let's talk about the nativity out back here, which will bring us to the workshop too. As we walk back to the Nativity, tell us about the workshop, which is where you do a lot of heavy lifting.
Well, listen, of course, not only as homeowners know, not only for yearly maintenance and every part of the property that needs to be maintained, but to maintain all these decorations, it is extremely nice to have a dedicated space.
Yep.
I have, you know, not a master mechanic or a master carpenter. I have kind of a jack-of-all-trades type workshop. I've got my bandsaw, my drill press, and my big workbench with the vices, and a big roll-away tool chest with all that good stuff. And it's just really nice to have a dedicated space that you can go to and make a mess and do what you have to do.
You can put something in the vice with some glue and let it sit there overnight, come back.
Make noise? And, yeah. Guy things, okay?
That's right.
So just to tell you a quick thing
we're at the back of the driveway. We're looking at the Nativity, which is over at the garage. And this, before we get started, first of all, tell us how many figures are in this Nativity scene.
4, 6, 8, 10, 12. I see 14 right here, my counting. So now, just to give a person an idea of where we're staying on the property relative to a car staying on the street, we are probably 120 yards, literally, off the street.
Yeah.
And from the street, you can see this bold as day. So, once again, because of the shape of the property and the simple fact that we have so many figures in our front yard and middle yard, I wanted a dedicated spot for the Nativity. And on top of this garage has always just been a really logical, good location.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have the baby. The baby is mounted vertically. He's attached. He's screwed to the overhang where you drive your car into the garage with all the figures above. I have extreme windproofing on all these figures here. Everything is weighed down with bricks, and it is when the wind comes howling through here, it'll just, I've learned lessons from past years. So yeah, this is our Nativity. I've always wanted to put this in the front of the property, but I just, with the size of it and everything else, and I hate to say it, I've always been paranoid about having the baby stolen, or about having any of my figures stolen.
Yeah, so let's sort of walk through this scene. So let's start over at the left.
Starting on the left, we have a classic shepherd boy, which is a figure that a lot of people would know. These are classic figures that most people would have grown up seeing. We then have one of the smaller camels, followed by the actual shepherd himself.
Right.
We then have a wise man kneeling with gifts. And then all behind them, we have standing wise men with gifts, standing in front of Joseph and Mary, who are above the baby. And then even further off to the right, we have even more wise men, including a very interesting one that was found this year. I don't know what vintage he is, but to me, he's very old because the lighting, the electrical implements were extremely old. I think he could possibly be from the 1950s. He's wearing a turban, and he has jewels in his turban. Followed by another small camel. And then above all of it, I have an angel above the entire scene. Yeah. It's mounted up on an aluminum ladder. So, that's our big nativity.
It's quite impressive. It's quite impressive. Linda, are you ready to go into the kitchen and talk about your counter? All right, so now...
Where do you guys, this kitchen?
We're going to go... Okay, now, so I will just say this for everyone listening. Just because we're going into your kitchen doesn't mean people listening can... Okay, just like this is, but I wanted to go inside the house to give people a sense. You get it, so within, so without, right? So without, so within. So let's take a peek into Linda's world. Okay, so let's go into the kitchen. We're gonna go through the back way. Oh, Linda, it's amazing. All right, wow. All right, so now we've walked in the back. We're in the kitchen, and. So Linda, we're in your kitchen, and you have a very nice central counter, and it's covered in Santa Clauses.
Yes.
It looks like you could have easily have 100 Santa Clauses on this counter. Mm-hmm. So why don't we get ready the oldest, the one that has the bell that you were gonna. Let's get that one ready. And this is an early one. Okay, let's just put that aside for a second because I want you to turn it on in a minute. So this is your kitchen counter for Christmas. It's covered with about 100 Santas. Why don't you tell us about the curation of your Santa collection?
I have Santas from probably every decade since probably the 40s. A lot of them are from when I was a child. And just, you know, a lot of them are from thrift stores and whatever over the years. But my system in the kitchen, basically what I do is I have lots of carolers and angels around the windows. And then I have a window box that's totally full of reindeer. And then I have a section of sleighs with Santa and the reindeer. And then I have snowman area, and I have a tree area.
Right.
And then I have a huge art area of my two children's grammar school work. And then we have just, you know, we have mechanical ones. We have, different things hanging.
It's impressive, Linda. So why don't we turn on this Santa that I'm particularly fond of, and this is one that you've had for quite some time.
Probably about 50 years.
Okay. So why don't you describe this one? Oh, you're gonna turn it on. Okay, here we go.
Anyway, he's a Santa. He walks and he plays the bell, and he's in pretty darn good shape for being probably at least 50 years old.
Thank you. All right, where's Adam? We need Adam. Adam's wandered off to get more tchotchkes. Linda, why don't we start? We're gonna wrap this up. And we're gonna wrap this up by blowing everyone's mind because we've just spent the last 20 minutes talking about your Christmas decorations, and I think what people need to understand is that this avalanche of work for Christmas. It's just one of three.
It's the ending of 3 months of decorating.
Right. So why don't you just sort of block out for us how this works, starting with in anticipation of Halloween.
So probably getting towards the end of September, What we do is my two sons and I, we kind of have like a little caravan of the three of us getting them out of the attic we have. And so we have an area up there where we have all of our Halloween, a lot of low mold Halloween. So that's up for a month. We have a Department 56 Halloween Village.
And Department 56 is the name of the pottery.
That's the name of the company that made all these buildings. And they specialize in Christmas, but we have a lot of Halloween. And then after Halloween, the things go back, and then I have a huge collection of Thanksgiving. So we have the pilgrims and the Indians and whatever, the turkeys for Thanksgiving.
And I'm gonna interrupt you for a second. So people might be thinking that, oh, your kitchen counter gets seasonally decorated. No, you're talking, you decorate your lawn for Halloween and Thanksgiving too.
Yes. Yeah. So we have really a lot of the Halloween outside. We don't have as much Thanksgiving. They're very hard to find. But we do have a lot of scarecrows and turkey and some pilgrims for Thanksgiving.
So when did you, you won this award this year, 2017. You won the award in 2013. How far back, at what point did you and Adam decide this was something you were really going to go whole hog for, as you have been?
I don't think we ever thought about the awards other than...
No. I don't mean the awards. At what point, Adam, come on back over. At what point did you decide this was something?
I think that you say you use the term whole hog, and I mean that may be appropriate. I think just when we reached a point where we'd accumulated enough decorations to where, you know, it started to seem like, wow, this is a lot of work each year getting all this out. And that's kind of when you start to know it's more than just, you know, for example, when we do Thanksgiving, we have four or five boxes. We have a couple items in the attic. Simple. And for some people, that's what their whole Halloween or Christmas is. But when it starts to get to be a major event, just unpacking things, you know you're committed at that point. And then the neighborhood, I think, starts to expect it. I think you kind of start to expect it of yourself. And so, you know, it's, I think, whether you like it or not, it sucks you in. And come on, it's jolly. You have to do it.
The home was remodeled 20 years ago. So this house only used to be like 1,300 square feet.
Right.
So, and then he was gone to Chico for college for 6 years. And so I used to have to do it all by myself. So it was never, I would say maybe we started putting more and more outside maybe 10 years, do you think, or
less? Well, I think a big factor, too, like she says, regarding the house being remodeled, is that it gave us that storage potential that we didn't have before. If we didn't have the storage in our attic, I wouldn't have that workshop. I wouldn't have some of these other spaces. So because the blow mold figures are, they don't exactly, you know, pack down like a string of lights. So that was a big factor, too. Just it opened up, I think, well, I guess we could buy that if we want to.
Things were just kept in a few closets and in the garage. So, you know, I guess having the room probably really extensively maybe the last 7-8 years, something like that, just a little bit more every year.
I'm going to say 10 years where we've been doing something nice. 5 years now where it's really been pa-pow to most people that would come by. But, I mean, we've been decorating my entire life as a kid. It's just something that you do, and it's something that's great to have in the house. But it expands exponentially every year.
All right, so we're gonna wrap this up, and I want each of you to give us your advice to the people at home listening. Linda, would you ever recommend anyone go down this path?
I would if you love this type of thing. I love vintage things, and I love collecting. It's a fact, collecting is a very healthy hobby. And so anybody that's really into the holidays, is into collecting, enjoys the hunt of finding things, but also economically, then I would highly recommend it. Yeah, it's really been fun.
Okay, good.
It really has. But also, I will honestly say, I love in January when all my regular things come out for the next 9 months, because it's 3 months of so much stuff put in closets, and it's decorations for 3 months.
All right.
So, yeah.
Good. Okay, good. And Adam, I'm going to ask you the same question. Would you recommend anyone go down this road? And if so, what would you advise them?
I would recommend it 100%, especially to anyone that truly values and cherishes classic Americana the way that I do. I certainly, for the purposes of this podcast, would never launch into any politics. But I just want to say, I think that some of classic Americana is, it's a little bit under fire a little bit these days. And to me, the history of the United States is, it has a breadth to it, and it's wide and varied. And to me, Christmas is the most wonderful time of the year. And we talked about the warm glow of the lights outside and the blow 'em all figures. And to me, it's a special thing. It's a special thing for a child in their bed at night to see the glow of the lights through their window. And it brings joy to other people. And I appreciate, I genuinely say, because I have been in the homes of Jewish and many faiths celebrating their individual respective holidays, and I've had a wonderful time at all. And Christmas to me is the wonderful holiday that I love to celebrate. And sadly, our neighborhood is now relatively dark in terms of the rest of the homes as compared to our property. It's such to the point where when I tell people to see our property, I don't even give them an address. I simply tell them the name of the street. I say, you'll know the house. You'll know the house. So, but for me, it's a special thing. It brings joy. It does bring joy to other people. There are times where it does not bring joy to me, and I'm cussing a little bit because the decoration is fighting me. But overall, it's always worth it. It's always worth it overall to have them set up.
But I would say it's a great tradition. For me, when I was a little girl, you know,
And you grew up here in Arcadia.
You know, people didn't put extensive stuff out, but my father always put lights on the roof. It was so bright in my bedroom that I could read my Nancy Drew books, you know, that and stuff. It was so bright, and I always remember that. And I think if you start traditions, and so Adam always had a mother who put out something, and I just really loved that. And I think it's a really important thing, you know, to have that, because I really think it's going by the wayside, you know. And so many people, we drove around the other night, and so many people just had the, you know, those lights that they just flash on the sides of the house.
I forget what you call projectors. Yeah, these new projector devices.
I don't know. That's a whole different thing, and it's, I like having the rarity, you know, what we have. I think it's really special.
We are old fashioned. My mother and I, in many respects. I believe it or not, I may be one of the last people in Southern California who actually does not carry a cell phone. Yes, I repeat what I just said. I do not carry a cell phone. My mother insists, despite a beautiful dishwasher, she likes to hand wash dishes. We do have things. We like having a landline. We are old-fashioned to a degree, and it definitely reflects, I would say, in both our collections and certainly our Christmas decorations.
All right. You two are amazing. I'm going to ask both of you in turn to say good night and thank everyone for listening. This is just fantastic. I just love this. So, Adam?
Yes. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. I wish a Merry Christmas, of course, and a Happy New Year to all of you. And please, even if it's just a simple little light-up deer you got at Home Depot, or even if it's just a bush or your mailbox post, I don't care. I'm happy that you took that effort to put something out there, because people like me, we notice it when we do drive down the road. And keep Christmas alive. Keep Christmas alive. And thank you for listening. I hope you got a little bit of enjoyment. You guys can hear I'm a talker, obviously. So I'm just right for this type of an interview. But we hope that you have a great holiday season. And I think that about wraps it up for me.
Adam, thank you so much. And Linda, it is you're going to say goodnight to all of us.
Good night, everyone, and thank you so much for listening. Happy holidays, and everyone, be kind to everybody every single day. Everyone, have kindness in your heart, and that's the special time I think of this year, you know.
God bless you, Linda.
My name is Stephen Luftman. I'm here at Arto's Broadway Cafe, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast for the month of January 2018. Yes, this is You Can't Eat the Sunshine. Our guests this month were author Brad Schreiber. He's talking about his book Revolution's End and his bus tour based on this book, which is coming up in February. We also spoke with Linda Jensen and her son Adam Wadlow. They are the winners, once again, of an Arcadia Beautiful Holiday Decoration Award for their vintage illuminated blow mold plastic figure yard decorations for Christmas. Oh, that was an amazing.
You know, I tried to convince them that they should start manufacturing these vintage blow molds, which are so hard to find. I'm like, you've just described that they're like 20 seconds to make. Maybe you should get a factory. And Adam's just like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Thoughts have wings. Mm-hmm. All right, so it's over. We did it. Kim, I want to thank you. Well, we're in the home stretch, so okay. Now is the time when you do two things in this order, feedback and upcoming tours.
Well, yeah, I remember. Feedback. Do you like this podcast? If you do, send us an email. YouCan'tEatTheSunshine@gmail.com or through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. Or, of course, you can get on the bus or join us at the Crime Lab or one of the Lava Sunday salons and just tell us that you dig the show. It's always nice to have that kind of feedback. And, too, if you're listening through one of the many podcast aggregators, you could give us a review, and that'll help other people find the show. As for upcoming events, and yes, there are a few. This week, we always start our touring year in the same way. We take the Real Black Dahlia tour. We start in downtown. We end up in Leimert Park. We are following in the footsteps and then in the motion of the corpse of Elizabeth Short, the victim, in the still unsolved 1947 murder mystery, which is our city's most iconic and celebrated unsolved crime. And it's a wonderful window into a very fascinating era in Los Angeles, right before the big, big boom that gave us the city that we know. And, you know, if you want to understand policing and social activities and journalism and all of the interesting subsets of, well, subculture in Los Angeles in 1946-47, you could do worse than join us on The Real Black Dahlia. We're nearly sold out. I think I have seven seats left, so get on the bus. We have the following Saturday, January 13th, in a lonely place, Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles. We'll start in downtown when Raymond Chandler was an oil company executive and quite good at it, too. Unfortunately, he ran around with women and he drank and the depression hit and many, many things happened. And somehow,
thank goodness,
he ended up as a detective novelist and a screenwriter. And the cool thing about this tour and about the work we get to do is that we've managed to rewrite Raymond Chandler's biography. Probably because we don't work closely with the authorities. In any case, we found things no one else has found. Some of them are quite fascinating. All of them take place in really extraordinary time capsules. So join us, do. On the 20th of January, we have a very, very occasional tour, which is the sister tour of the Chandler Expedition. It's called The Birth of Noir, and it focuses on the novelist James M. Cain and the adaptations of books like The Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce into the cinema. And we'll actually go to Glendale, to Mildred Pierce's house, and we'll talk about what happens if you're a young person in Southern California and you have nobody close by and your baby dies. There is a place for that baby. And we'll talk about how important Skid Row is to finding the American vernacular. It's an adventure. I love that tour.
It's a good tour.
I'm not going to push this one too hard because it's been sold out for 4 months now. But on January 27th, we're doing the Lowdown on Downtown. Everyone wants to get into the Dutch Chocolate Shop by Ernest Bachelder, the tiled interior, which we are the only tour company that have access to that site at this point, which is closed. And I'm very happy that we do. And because this did sell out so soon, we're also going to do the Lowdown on Downtown, which is a tour about
April 14th.
We're going to do it April 14th. It's a tour about redevelopment and how downtown has risen and fallen and all of the many layers and narratives, none of which you will hear from your realtor. I promise you. It's the real story on downtown from some of the real people who lived it. And it's a pretty astonishing place. There's a reason most of our tours focus on it.
I'm going to interrupt this. I know we're in the home stretch here. I just, you know, the last year,
we gave this tour to some Estonian city planners who were from Riga. Do you want to tell the audience at home? No? They liked it.
They liked it.
They were just like, they were like, wow, like, this is a really, like, this is a really good tour. You guys really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I don't know if they actually wrote a check, so maybe they don't. People don't want us giving that tour too often to the city planners. But in any case, okay, so that's the lowdown on downtown. On Sunday the 28th, we have Nathan's Lava Sunday Salon, free with RSVP. Bringing us into February on the 10th, it's Brad Schreiber's 2 Days in South L.A., the 1974 SLA Shootout Special Edition Tour. February 17th, Weird West Adams, a crime tour with a side of social justice. And a visit to the beautiful Rosedale Cemetery and some of the weirdest tales of old L.A. I think we'll even go to Alvarado Terrace. Why not? On the 24th of February, it's the Boyle Heights and Monterey Park Hidden Histories of L.A.'s Melting Pot Tour, 100 years of immigration and astonishingly wonderful spaces created for the people of the East Side. And if you've never visited El Encanto or Divine's Furniture or, well, golly, the world's your oyster. Get on that bus. Then a couple more crime bus tours in March. We have Echo Park Book of the Dead on March the 3rd, which includes a visit to Sister Amy Simple McPherson's house museum on Echo Park. And that does contain the most beautiful bathroom. You know, usually I say in Los Angeles. Today I'm going to say in the world. I can't think of a more beautiful bathroom
nice.
Than Sister Amy's. And you can't use it, but you can admire it. And then East Side Babylon on March the 10th, our most unhinged crime bus tour. And talking about cemetery walks, we'll be going through Evergreen. Other things coming up. Oh, gosh, Richard, I have page 2 here. Let's see. Desert Visionaries 2 is on March 17th. That's a special day out in the Antelope Valley. Yes, it's St. Patrick's Day, and Father Patrick will be meeting us. We have Pasadena Confidential on March 24th. You know, just your typical crime bus tour, rocket science, black magician, presidential assassins, inappropriate pets of millionaires. Oh, I love Pasadena. And now I know we can't actually go out onto the Colorado Street Bridge, Suicide Bridge, if you will, and talk about the poor people who lost their lives there because they've put up some of the most astonishingly insensitive suicide netting you've ever seen in your life. So we'll stand on the outskirts of the bridge and talk about it. That's okay. The city's going to get it together and do something prettier. Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice at the end of March, the 31st, a downtown double feature of serial killings, burlesque dancers, wax museums, mummified corpses, all the things you love. We'll be again doing the Real Black Dahlia on April the 7th, and the Lowdown on Downtown, as I've mentioned, returns on April 14th, and that is a whole bunch of tours, so that's all you need to know.
Okay. Kim, thank you. You did it. I want to thank you, Kim. I want to thank everyone at home listening. I want to encourage you at home to continue to listen, to stay tuned, and I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La, 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park. Gold mine of fabulous oddities like Root Hair, Snary, Angela Savvy, Bob McBoy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline.